Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Triangulation, episode number 364 for Friday, September 14th, 2018. Anya Kamenetz. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Rate Shield Approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. It's a real game changer. Learn more and get started at rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. Welcome to Triangulation. This is a show where we talk to the greatest minds in tech, the people making the tech, studying the tech, researching the tech, giving us a sort of anxiety relief from the tech. My guest today, I'm super excited to talk to, Anya Kamenetz, is an NPR reporter for NPR Education. She is their lead education blogger, and she covers online and on air, covering learning and technology. And she has authored several books, including most recently, The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
So I wanted to start by asking you to read a little passage from your book, because I think a lot of people, when they hear we're going to talk about this topic, especially in the past week when since the World Health Organization has declared gaming disorder as a disease, there's a lot of people who are feeling like, just not another person who's spreading FUD, like fear, uncertainty and doubt, not another person who's just going to make us more anxious, criticize our parenting. So I wanted to read a little passage from the very beginning the book to give an idea of what the writing is like.
I'm so happy you asked me to do this. It's like no one's ever asked me to do this. So this is from the first chapter. This is The Art of Screen Time, Digital Parenting in the Real World. And I'm kind of talking about how why I felt like I needed this book and what's changed and what's maybe the same. So children today first engage with digital media at the average age of 4 months, or almost as soon as they can focus past the end of their noses. In the 1970s, that average age was 4 years. And according to a Pew survey in 2015, almost half of parents of school-aged children say that their children spend too much time with screens. On average, kids in the United States spend as much time daily with electronic media as on any other waking activity, including school. Astonishing. But so what? As parents, we find ourselves without traditions or folk wisdom or, crucially, enough relevant scientific evidence in answering that question. Traditional authorities covering for real gaps in knowledge fall back on tired tropes. And I think the self-proclaimed experts have let us down in our attempt to make sense of this incredible new reality. In the absence of grandma's advice or a wealth of up-to-date research studies, the source of knowledge that we consult to resolve not only these conflicts, but seemingly every question and hiccup in our children's lives and our own, is ironically the internet. Dr. Google is the new Dr. Spock.
So this book, once I read that, I was like, okay, I'm in. As you can see, I have many post-it notes throughout the book, notes from my own life. And what I like is you have much smaller kids than I do. My kids are teenagers, but you're really not, even though I saw recently you gave a talk to the Family Action Network and called this me search when you really research something that you need, but you really covered all of the ages. And also just the fact that as parents, specifically mothers, we have a lot of work, a lot of issues with this too. And so I want to get to that. But one of my favorite things about your book was that you borrowed from Michael Pollan, the food writer. He said, eat too much, eat food, not too much.
Not too much.
Mostly vegetables. Is that what he said?
Mostly plants.
Yes. And you said, use screens not too often, mostly together. And I love that. That was such an inspiration. So can you talk a little bit about how you came to that?
Yeah. First of all, people are busy. So I wanted to have a handle on the book that people could kind of understand the message pretty quickly. I understand the message of balance, but I think that we've been shortchanging ourselves when we talk to parents and we just talk about cutting back. And that is sort of the not too much part of the equation. I think that's part of it. But the enjoy screens and the mostly together are kind of the other parts of my message where I say, hey, wait a minute, this digital technology, it's in our lives for a reason. You know, it connects us to new ideas. It helps us express ourselves creatively. It helps us discover new things in the world, discover new affinities. And we want to share that with our children. And so the way that we do that is by using screens together, by engaging over digital media and modeling types of use that are going beyond kind of the consumption that everybody loves to, you know, beat up on. Although, you know, I put in a word there for consumption too, fandom and sharing stories together or not, you know, beyond the pale. It's also part of a healthy, balanced media diet. That's kind of the bottom line.
And so, you know, we hear tons of research, you know, some junk science, some based on years of research long before the iPhone or the computer came around.
Yeah.
But there haven't been, I mean, we're only very soon getting longitudinal studies on what smartphones and technology like that are doing to our children. So talk a little bit about like the problems with the research that's out there right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think every practitioner would say the problems with the research is that there's not enough of it and not enough funding and not enough non-biased funding. So the point that drives this home is the last major federally funded study on children and media was published in 1982 by the National Institutes of Health, National Institutes of Mental Health, I'm sorry. So there's clearly a lot that's been going on that we don't have up-to-date research on. And if you think about how hard it is to design a study for children in particular, especially when we have some indicators that media might not be so helpful or might be harmful, it's really, really hard to get approval for that kind of research. And so the studies that we do have, they're not necessarily experimental. They're not randomized controlled studies. And it's really hard then to draw as powerful conclusions as many people are from the studies we do have.
Right. No one's willing to say, OK, give me 100 babies. We're going to give them an iPhone and tape it to their fingers for the next 10 years and see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, there might be a few people who would volunteer for that, but then they would have different things going on at home that we don't really want to think about too much.
So I mean, what is some of the research that you looked into for kids or adolescents that you felt wasn't junk science that really did have some reality in it?
So the stuff I found compelling, it was a combination of the amount of research over time as well as how well researchers understood the mechanisms behind it. And the number one thing I landed on was sleep. You know, we know that the light that's shining in our eyes and close to our faces, especially that blue-toned light, is inhibiting your body's ability to make melatonin, which is what you need to be sleepy and feel sleepy. This is especially impactful for kids and teens. Their brains are developing. They need sleep to consolidate their memories and learning. And sleep also has a lot of emotional impact on children as they grow. When they're underslept, it regresses their ability to tolerate frustration, and they get very moody. And sort of there's a paradigm of a kid who is hyperactive, has a lot of trouble settling down, and you give them screens, which it seems like it's calming them, but really it's very stimulating. And so they might get into a vicious circle where they didn't sleep well the night before, and then they're kind of all over the place, and you give them screens again because they're kind of craving that stimulation because their brains are kind of locked into needing more and more. So the sleep is one big area. Obviously, obesity, we have a lot of research on, mostly related to television. And that has to do with potentially the advertising messages more than anything else, as well as potentially mindless eating while you're watching. And those are the two areas that I think that seem to be the most well-founded. They're very basic. They're not necessarily the biggest bugaboos that parents worry about. But especially when it comes to sleep, they can be insidious, and they obviously affect parents as well.
Yeah, and that's definitely what I've found, my experience and, you know, I will fall back a lot on what I think, even you write about the common thing we do is compare ourselves to other parents, and it's just built in. But, you know, the parents that it's always been shocking to me, parents who are very concerned with, like, the types of media, like violent video games or, you know, rated R movies, and then will allow their child to keep their iPhone in their bedroom all night because it's their alarm clock. Like, that's, you know, that,
right.
And it's like, well, buy an alarm clock, you know, that, right. But so it's just something. And I think what's interesting when you're talking about those two things is like, that's a good rule for kids and adults, keeping your phone somewhere, yeah, not near your bed, and also not sitting in front of the TV watching TV and eating, you know, bad for your food.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, a lot of this stuff is really common sense. And another point I would add to that is that when it comes to dangers to kids with media and digital devices, probably the number one is parents driving with phones in their hands, like just by the numbers, because school age children, car crashes are the number one cause of death. And phones are pushing up the level of car crashes that we have. So, you know, this is not something that you see when you have a digital safety curriculum, but I think it should be front and center in people's minds. And another area, for example, where there's a fair amount of evidence that's interesting and kind of a sleeper one is background television. So we know from decades of research, first of all, very large chunk of parents by surveys still have the TV on all or almost all of the time that they're at home. And what we can see from the research is that there's a giant drop in parent-child conversation when the television's on. And that for small children, their play gets interrupted when they're television on, even if it's quote unquote in the background. And I was actually just speaking to parents of a baby who were in a research intervention where they were actually recording their baby's speech. This is the number one thing that they noticed. They said, you know, we had our baby, we brought her home, and we used to just like switch on the television for a little bit of downtime. And we noticed how we didn't have that conversation, that interaction when the television was on. And so now we don't do it anymore. And so I wonder how much parents, and these are all things, it's not a coincidence, I'm pointing to things that parents could be doing differently, when it comes to kids and media.
So immediately when you say that, I start to feel really guilty about the fact that when I was nursing.
Oh, sorry. Let's back it up.
No, I mean, I want to bring up that point because I was thinking, you know, there were no iPhones when I was nursing my kids, but I watched the entire season of Sex and the City and The Sopranos while nursing them. And I'm thinking, oh, that background television. Yeah. And, you know, of course, there was no one else there for me to be interacting with. Right. So there's not that. But you talk a lot about that. You talk about your own guilt of feeling like nursing with your iPhone. And and your book really kind of says we're all doing the best we can. And that's part of what I love about your book. It's real science, but it's not judging. So what do you say to parents who are just like, and especially this is real class issue too. It's a gender issue and a class issue, because a lot of people don't have, a lot of people don't have access to care that people of, you know, with more money do. So talk a little bit about how parents can deal with their own anxiety and guilt around this.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really glad you brought that up. I think that that's a really key part of this message. It's a tricky thing it's a line to walk as a book author, because the people who are most interested in hearing about this, who are concerned, are probably the ones that are doing just fine. You know, and every so often you meet a parent who has a kid who has a real problem, and we can talk about that. But we have to remember too that these conversations about perfecting our family life, whether that be about nutrition or fitness or screens, it's all kind of on this background of the cultural script that we're running, which is that the perfect parent is a mom who is completely invested in her child 24/7, who cares about nothing except their development and their well-being, and who is constantly stimulating them and trying to educate them and speak to them and get them going, you know, on the path for the, you know, Harvard and whatever is beyond that. Right. So that's the script that's running. And when you say condemn, you know, when you're condemning, for example, parents who are on their iPhones at a restaurant or the kids are on a tablet, you're comparing it to something imaginary that doesn't exist, because nobody is that perfect parent. And our kids actually don't need us to be there for them 24/7. That's a very damaging myth that a lot of other books are taking on at the moment. The idea that helicopter parenting is the best way to produce healthy kids is really being massively debunked. And so what I kind of root for in the book is a different paradigm, where you say you're a little bit more relaxed about screen time, but you're also more relaxed about your kid having nothing to do. So a lot of times people put on the screen because they're like, oh my God, I have to cook dinner. And what happens when I have to cook dinner? And it's like, your kid has to deal with it. they have to be able to like deal with it for 20 minutes when you cook dinner. And that's part of your parenting too, is like being able to foster that in your kid and not always having to be there hovering or offering commentary or whatever it is that we are supposed to be doing according to, you know, the gods of parenting.
And I mean, and you make a point also in your book about how it depends on the child too. Like you have a story about two kids in a family. One needs a lot of medical care that they can stay calm with by using the iPad, and his sister can't use the iPad at the same time. So talk a little bit about that story and how you can really just with the fact that like all parents, you don't judge another parent because you don't know what their kid is like. And sometimes you have more than one kid of your own that has different needs.
Yes, every kid is different. And when it comes to issues or problems with screens, there are so many things that it's important to watch out for. I mean, some known correlations that we know about are that kids that have a little bit of problems with emotional regulation, even as young as 9 months old, are more likely to be watching more television as they get older. And kids on the autism spectrum are very, very drawn to time with screens. And so are kids with ADHD. And so there may be some situations where screens exacerbate conditions or they push kids into a cycle that you don't always want to see. And so for those kids, you might want to set stricter limits. On the other hand, you know, if you have a kid like the one that you mentioned is a little boy with cystic fibrosis, he needs all of these therapies and care, it makes a lot of sense to me to think about the media use as a coping mechanism and something that's an accommodation that's available to that kid. And, you know, there are kids, I know parents tell me about kids who have a lot of social anxiety. Elementary school is really tough for them. And when they get home, they really need to decompress and be in a space that they can control. And that's the video game for them. You know, and so what I would just urge parents to do is follow their intuition, look at it holistically and say, is this helpful for my kid? Is it not helpful for my kid? What do I observe before and after the media sessions? What happens if we skip it? And play around and do a little bit of your own experimentation. Don't be afraid to kind of try different things. And if you conclude that you have a kid who thrives on a certain amount of media, you know, you should be unapologetic about that.
And so what is the science behind kids who are on the autism spectrum or who have ADD? And I mean, what's the link between that and, you know, and where a parent might want to limit screens? And is it because maybe kids like that are harder and that a parent might have to depend on screens more often? Or is that not? What's causation? What's correlation there?
Great questions. Okay, so let's split it out. Attentional disorders, there have been large-scale correlational studies showing very, very small correlations. Again, they can't prove causation, right, with attentional disturbance and media use. So is it that kids who are easily distracted are enticed by the repetitive and very stimulating structure of a game or of a show? Could be. Or is it something about, you know, the bombardment with stimulation, especially for very young children, that somehow skews their developmental pathway? We don't know. We may never know. But there are small correlations. I should mention here as well that some particular video games have been developed to enhance attentional control. And those have some FDA backing as well. So there's two sides to that story. Autism spectrum, very well documented correlation, again, between kids on the spectrum and the amount of media that they use, even at very young ages. No evidence that this is a causal thing. When you talk about intervention pathways for kids with autism, one of the state of the art therapies is called applied behavior analysis. It's this very kind of intense behaviorist training, essentially, where you're prompting and cueing and rewarding kids for certain kinds of behavior. One clinician I talked to, a very, very eminent clinician, Dr. Jenny Rudetsky, says it could be that if you have a kid who's obsessed with Thomas the Tank Engine and you are giving them that video to get through the bath time or to get through the meal time, they're missing out on the kinds of the bits of therapy that they need throughout the course of the day. I also spoke to an autism advocate who said, that's ridiculous. You know, autism is genetic entirely, and, you know, my kid needs his media to get through his day, and that's an accommodation, not something that is making him worse. So, you know, it's a very complicated issue. And again, I would really urge parents to, there's no smoking guns here. So I would really urge parents to kind of look at their own kids and in the long term, in the short term, what kinds of effects do you observe?
I spoke to Dr. Radesky earlier this year, and she's great, and it just makes me wonder, because I think parenting decisions are always so fraught, and you know it's such a, you just want to raise your kid the best you can, and so there's a lot of judgment, as I said before, and it makes me think, because Jenny is great, and I'm sure there's a lot of people that really disagree with her, as the woman that you said before. I mean, have you experienced that? Like have you experienced judgment after writing this book or writing about this topic for a while, of people who are just like very, you know, just strong in their beliefs that might be different than yours?
I have to say, crossing my fingers, that I feel like I've struck a tone that people who have been paying attention have been happy to hear it, and sort of like, okay, here's a low judgment space. Mm-hmm. Because I really am coming down. I mean, there might be a few people out there who might be saying, oh, she's not being tough enough on media. But honestly, it feels to me like it's a good place that we've landed in, where I'm just trying to say, look, let's have a non-judgmental and yet informed conversation about this. And that's great, because we obviously live in a world where people are very ready to debate and argue at the drop of a hat. And I've had the experience with my previous books before sometimes where some people get very, very upset, and this just hasn't been that. And I'm very grateful.
That's good. I'll knock on some wood.
Knock on wood, yeah.
Maybe we have bigger things to fight about these days than this. I want to talk. Go ahead.
Well, on that point, like one of the great people I connected with in writing this book was Renee DiResta. I don't know if you know her work.
No.
You should have her on the show. She is an expert in misinformation and disinformation. And the way that she came to that work was through her work in anti-vaxxer communities. So she was trying to mobilize pressure of real moms who trust medical science and pushing it back against all these conspiracy theorists. And that's what led her to kind of think about how misinformation works online and how people have their misapprehensions confirmed. And I just am so struck by that, because that idea of, you know, mothers are going out there to find answers about their kids, who maybe something terrible happened to their kids, maybe their kids are autistic or sick, and they're just tumbling down these rabbit holes of misinformation. And we so need good sources of information to counter that.
Absolutely. Yeah, the vaccinations is such a great example of that, because you want, if something horrible has happened, you want to have a call, you want to know why something like that. And that's the same thing with, you know, with screen time too. Like if there's something, but with screen time, it's really like it was in our hands. You know, we were the ones that had the, you know, the ability to turn off the TV or get rid of TV or you never give your kid an iPhone or, you know, all those things. So it really feels like we're, you know, holding the weight. But I want to talk about arguing and on the same topic of the news I mentioned earlier that the World Health Organization has decided that gaming disorder is a disease like gambling disorder and other addictions. And I want to talk about some of the what experts are talking about that. But first, I want to take a break to thank our sponsor. This episode of Triangulation is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. If you are in the market for a new home, even if you're just thinking about it, even if you just saw an open house that you drove by, looked like your dream house, maybe, possibly you're thinking you're going to buy a house, check out Rocket Mortgage, because buying a home can be confusing. And especially now, rising interest rates, there's a lot of unpredictability when it comes to buying a house. It's causing a lot of anxiety with folks. Well, our friends at Quicken Loans are doing something about it. They're calling it the power buying process, and here is how it works. Step one, you answer a few simple questions, then they will check your credit for pre-qualified approval. Step two, Quicken Loans will verify your income, your assets, and your credit in less than 24 hours to give you a verified approval, which gives you the strength of a cash buyer. You want that. Then step three, once you're verified, you qualify for their all new exclusive Rate Shield approval. Rate Shield approval locks up your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. Now here's the best part. If the rates go up, your rate stays the same. And if the rates go down, your rate also drops. So either way, you win. Win, win. Winning all around. We want winning. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. You can find out all the information that you want. Everything that I've told you and more. Rate Shield approval is only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. And that's rocketmortgage.com/triangulation. And we thank Rocket Mortgage for their support of this triangulation. I am talking to Anya Kamenetz. She wrote The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Life and Digital Media and Real Life. Digital Life. Obviously, it's a work in progress for me. And I want to talk about gaming disorder. It was added as one of the addiction disorders by the World Health Organization. And some people are really excited about that. And others are critical and, you know, suspect of this. This week on one of other shows, I spoke to Dr. Mike Bishop, who runs Summerland camps. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
I am.
And, you know, and he was excited about this because, you know, his camps might be able to, you know, people might be able to pay for his camps with insurance, which is great because right now it's expensive to send your kid to a camp like that. And they haven't necessarily proven that they're going to be able to solve any of your problems. And you know, our conversation we had sort of delved in a little bit into violent video games, not just violent video games, but violent video games. And your description is a really good one in here. You point to the research between violent media and kids' behavior, and it's been since 1961. So I want to talk a little bit about that. Those are two big topics, video game addiction and violent video games. Let's start with the gaming disorder. What were your thoughts? That was obviously after you've written the book, but what are your thoughts on this new designation?
Sure. So it's a complicated issue. We know that in the United States, in the DSM, which is the psychiatrist's Bible, it's listed as a condition for further study. So they haven't come out with a new edition since 2013. So it's been a while. And we also know that in countries, including mostly in East Asia, this has been recognized for some time, and there's a whole network of treatment centers and different kinds of interventions. So the question is not, are there some people, mainly young men, a great portion of them on the autism spectrum, a great portion of them with ADHD, a great portion of them with anxiety or depression, young men who spend too much time playing video games. That's not disputed. It's a very small percentage of the people who play video games because most American households play some video games. So it's important to establish that baseline. It's not addictive the way heroin is addictive, where like 95% of the people try it, ended up with a huge problem, right? Or fentanyl or whatever. This is more on the order of, you know, probably a lower addiction rate than alcohol, but I'm spitballing here. I don't know the actual numbers in that to level of specificity, but something that's very, very common, like alcohol, but the percentage of addicts is much lower than that. So that's one area of concern. Is it just to understand the prevalence of it is important, because moral panics get started when people associate a certain activity with dangerous outcome, regardless of how actually dangerous it is. The second issue that people raise is with all of these co-occurring conditions, like people who usually have trouble playing video games also have usually something else going on in their lives. And so does it make the most sense to treat it as a standalone issue, or should you really be thinking about it and surrounding it with the other treatments for the other things that you're also having in your life, like family dynamics and, you know, depression, anxiety, those types of things. And it's always notable to me that we never had this conversation about television. You know, television arrived, everybody bought one, people started watching it 35 hours a week. There's certainly some people who watch it 100 hours a week, but we don't call them addicts, we call them depressed, right? So I think that's it. Like, why is that so different? What is it about that? Is it just the relationship people observe to the video game, the preoccupation with it? That's one reason. The other area, and I think Dr. Bishop talks about this, and when I interviewed him, he talked about this, that he prefers conceptualizing something as an addiction brings a lot of cultural baggage. And basically what it means is it's an organic brain disorder that is chronic and you'll have it for the rest of your life. That's kind of the contemporary understanding of addiction. And that's a tough thing to lay on a kid, a young person. And it becomes, you know, adolescents, they're forming their identities for their whole lives. And so if you lay a diagnosis like that on someone, how are you shaping their self-concept? And particularly if you put them into treatment and they are in treatment with people who may have even worse problems than they do they then identify with that person and start to, you know, say, this is my peer group. It's people who have really severe addictions. And I'm going to have this for the rest of my life. So from a viewpoint of how do you get people out of that situation of playing too many games, maybe calling it an addiction is not the most helpful thing, even if it meets the clinical criteria. So that's kind of the range of objections. Nobody's saying that this problem doesn't exist or that it doesn't achieve clinical significance. But people are arguing a lot about the details.
Well, we've spoken to a lot of the same people. I also spoke to the mediatrician from MIT, from Boston, from Harvard.
From Harvard,
mediatrician. Yeah. And he, when I was talking to him, I just said, well, my whole family's addicted to our iPhone. And he really pushed back on that word, just using that word. And his was a really good point that when you just throw it around like that, it's a way of avoiding the problem. Like, you know, just saying like, you know, I'm not probably technically addicted. Neither is anyone in my family. Whatever that means, it means different things to different people. But it's a way of shielding ourselves from what that right might really mean.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's a verbal tick that allows us to put off responsibility and not think about it as a problem that we're actually engaged in solving. And it's a response that I get a lot, frankly, when I say I've written a book about screen time, parents will say, oh my God, I'm so bad with that. Which is a little bit strange because it's like, well, I just read a book about lead and how it's toxic for children. Oh my God, we're so bad with that. We just let them eat lead all the time. It's not, if you really think it's a problem, maybe that's not the attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Self-effacing is a way we get through all this. Okay. So gaming disorder is separate from what you talk about, the connection between violent media and children's behavior. And I wanted you to talk about the Bobo the Clown study, which I think is from 1961. And talk a little bit about that.
Right. So this is a group of studies and they did follow, you know, the randomized controlled trial model. And it was, they showed children of footage of this clown puppet being hit on and destroyed. And then they released them onto the clown. And the children who'd seen the clown being hit were much more likely to hit and kick the clown. So that's why they can say that there's a causal relationship between watching violence in media and perpetrating violence. It's still very small. It's a small contributing factor. They don't have real life, you know, again, randomized controlled trials with real violent media. But they also have, that's very suggestive, is physiological data. So you know that when you're watching something that's very intense, you get that sympathetic reaction where your heart is pounding, your blood is up, your sensory organs are kind of, you know, paying more attention and your inhibitions are lowered. So you're kind of getting ready to jump in to the action that you see on the screen. And that's another way that they can kind of say, yeah, this is causing something to happen. It's not, you know, it's not just a coincidence. This energy that's whipped up in the body, it goes somewhere. That said, you know, they have a lot of trouble. No researcher is ever going to say that any piece of media caused any act of violence outside of an experimental context. They just don't have the ability to narrow it down in that way. And when you talk about the impact of violent media on the culture at large, you know, you have to kind of account for the fact that our society is getting a lot less violent, that our homicide rates are down, other kinds of interpersonal violence are down. So even as the, you know, video games like Fortnite take over the nation, the relationship is not so straightforward. And of course, the big exception everyone talks about is mass shooters, which is obviously very upsetting and also pretty much uniquely an American phenomenon, where, you know, first-person shooter video games are not. So again, it's a really complicated relationship. And I think on top of the scientific research and evidence is just a huge pile on of people with different agendas who are kind of doing tug of war back and forth and trying to prove one side or the other when the evidence doesn't necessarily show it.
Yeah, the agendas. I think that is really a big problem. And that's why I feel for people who are just really interested in the research, and something they say can be taken out of context. So in terms of, have you seen any research that violent video games and any other kind of video game might have the same effect on a child? Like whether they're playing, Grand Theft Auto or Fortnite or Minecraft, like, is there a difference on a children's behavior? Is there any science that can point to that?
There's two things to think about. One is the content of the game, and the other one is the mechanism of the game. So if you talk about the content of the game, yeah, graphic content has an impact on children. It affects them physiologically. And the impacts of violent content, aggression is the least common. This is coming from Dr. Michael Rich, the mediatrician. Mm-hmm. Aggression is the least common. Then anxiety and depression is a little more common. And the most common is desensitization. So the more you're exposed to it, the less of an impact it has. And that potentially also transfers over into real life context. So graphic content does matter. I think kids have different levels of sensitivity to it, and that might also be a factor of desensitization, but some kids have more of an ability to abstract what they're watching, and others are very, very identified with it. Now, the question of, what effect a game has on you, games can be more or less heavily gamified, right? So some games are constructed like slot machines. That's your basic kind of gamification structure, where there are lots of rewards. There are lots of near misses that you kind of look at like, oh my God, I could have won it. There's a lot of cliffhangers. So it makes it really, really hard to stop because they're always showing you one more thing that's around the bend, or there's one more level. The more of these kinds of mechanisms that are in the game, the harder it is to stop playing the game, the more preoccupied people get with games. A game like Minecraft that is completely open-ended, doesn't have a lot of those factors to it. It can still be very, very compelling, and you can still play it in a marathon, but it seems to be a little bit less manipulative in terms of how it's addressing, a young kid's psyche, or an adult for that matter. And then the social aspect of games is interesting, right? Because, games like Fortnite, where you're banding together with friends, can be very social, and that can be very healthy. It's a way to get together with friends. Assuming you're not doing it in the middle of algebra class. But at the same time, if it is the social aspect can make it really hard to stop again, because if you have a kid who is getting really preoccupied with games, most of their social life takes place on that platform, then you're not just cutting them off from the game, you're cutting them off from all their friends.
And so the social aspect is interesting. And World of Warcraft is the same way. Like, you have a team, and it's not necessarily your friends. It might be people that you don't know. And there was a thread on Twitter a few days ago, tell me something that happened wonderful in your life because of video games. And there were lots of people. I met my partner. Just very lovely stories. And somebody that follows me said, talked about how their World of Warcraft team or clan, I'm sure I'm getting the word wrong, it felt like a job. And when they won, it was amazing. And, they, like the person who led it had to be, they had to be there every day, and they really learned from that. And someone who has never played games that are so involved in that and has the image of World of Warcraft as like the person in their basement with, the bottles lined up because they can't go to the bathroom. you don't hear people say like this, I really got something out of this. And so, I guess I don't really have a question as much as...
It's a complex social world, right? Yeah, and I think that the social aspect you're talking about is another way that the games become so compelling, because you feel like you're letting down your buddies if you don't play. So I think that there's a bright side and a dark side to that, right?
And you did...
But yeah. No, go ahead.
You mentioned earlier just in passing that games can give kids a sense of control, that is a positive sense of control. And I definitely feel that with Minecraft. I mean, it's very hard to be a kid. And I mean, I can only imagine it's very hard to be a boy, but it seems like it is. In different ways, it is hard to be a girl. And I just do feel like I've seen a lot of young tweens and teens really feel like Minecraft, which you can also play among a group of kids on, you know, on a server, just really does give them a sense of control. And has there been any research or science to show the positive aspects of being able, like, you can't control anything. Your parents are telling you what to do. Your teachers are telling you what to do. And there's this world where you can create it. Has there been any research to show the positive effects of that?
There's been some good observational anthropological type research. So, you know, I credit often the work of Mimi Ito and her collaborators, Dana Boyd, and anthropologists who have gone in and actually talked to kids about their experiences and found that, you know, they're doing important work. You know, when you give them a chance, what kids are often doing is the paradigm is hanging out, messing around, and geeking out. So hanging out, meaning like just finding your friends, finding your affinity group, which could be something really important. You know, if you have, let's say you're like a trans kid growing up in Iowa, right? Internet might be the place where you find people that are like you, of your tribe. Messing around, meaning getting under the hood of technology and figuring out different ways to hack it and to edit video or to code. And then geeking out, just doing a deep dive in whatever your interest is. And we know these kids who, whether it's Minecraft, I hear a lot about makeup tutorials. I hear a lot about Instagram accounts of food. You know, learning a ton and then following people and learning from them. This is a basic kid activity that can be done online in a really beautiful way.
And so do you have any advice to keep that, like the positiveness of Minecraft, to keep it from, you know, what's moderation? Like, to keep it from the 12 hours a day of Minecraft or the, you know, the endless makeup tutorials on YouTube? Because you literally could do both of those things. Is there any way to, I guess my question is, what are some warning signs that maybe your kid has gone too far? And what's some advice you have for parents who are feeling that way?
Yeah, sure. So the problematic media use measure has been validated by one study. It's a parent report measure of kids. And it asks questions like, is using media your child's only preferred activity? Have they lost interest in other activities? Do they sneak around to use media? Do they break the rules and always seem to need more and more? Is it leading to problems in their lives? Have friendships fallen away? Are they missing birthday parties? Are they missing sleep? Are they missing school? Are they angry? Are you fighting with them about it? This is an issue. So it's not just the raw amount of time, but it really is what they're looking for is that you're preoccupied with the activity to the exclusion of other things, to the extent that it's actually causing real problems. And all of those things are important to keep in mind because parents are kind of defaulting to condemning their kids' media interests. And so it's naturally going to cause conflict if you are just so triggered by seeing your kid with their head down on the screen that you feel like everything they're doing there is stupid. So the corollary to that is as you think about those warning signs, and usually by the time parents notice it, you know, it might be pretty far gone. You should also think about, is there a way to build bridges towards your child's media interests? So, you know, a lot of us understand what it means to be a soccer mom, but we don't understand what it means to be a Minecraft mom. And is there a way, if your kid really truly loves something, to show interest in it and not only condemn it? And now, even if you have a soccer-loving kid, you're still going to insist that the kid, you know, comes to grandma's house and comes to meals and goes to bed. They can't play soccer all day long and all night long. But there's a time and a place for it, and you're going to be there cheering them on. And so that's kind of the balance, I think, that we all need to strike when it comes to kids with media.
And so, yes, we've been talking a lot about video games, but does social media, Instagram, Snapchat, Musical.ly, all whatever it is, does that have different effects? Is there different research about that that's even newer than video games?
Yes, it is newer than video games, and yes, it does have different effects. We see far more girls that use social media and that have problems with social media. social media is a very different animal from video games, because the addictive part of social media is your friends, right? So the need for social approval, the need for status, to project a certain image, to have people look at you a certain way, are all things that social media supplies, and it is very, let's say, optimized for the preoccupations of especially the teen girl brain. Right. And so the issues with social media is it is supposed to be a space that kids can get to each other away from parents. And so how do you actually have any say in that? One way, of course, is by talking to your kids about what they've seen online. And you shouldn't underestimate the power of that, because kids do listen to their parents even when they're pretending not to. A second thing that I've heard from teenage girls is that it can be a relief when your parents take the phone away at night, or even over a vacation, because teenagers feel an obligation to constantly respond to their friends. And if you can say, oh my God, my mom took my phone away, then it removes that obligation and they can kind of relax. The special case of kind of issues with social media have to do with social media amplifying certain mental health issues, right? So we have stories of teenagers who have issues with eating, issues with self-harm or suicidal ideation. And in the social space, it's very easy to share that in a way that connects you with others who are thinking the same things, that can confirm how you're feeling. So this is not a panic attack, but it's something to be aware of that, you know, many teens I know have dealt with. And to realize that it's out there and that you as a parent have the opportunity to serve as a responsible adult. And that also it's really important to enlist other responsible adults. So you might not be the person that your 15-year-old comes to, but it could be her best friend's mom could be the person, or it could be your niece, her cousin, or it could be someone else in the extended family, or a coach or a teacher. So the idea of having eyes in the street in the world of social media is really, really important.
Yeah, the eyes on the street reminds you. You talk about having like a sort of a first launching into social media, which I really experienced with my daughter. Wanted to have Instagram when she was, I don't know, sixth grade, 12 or 11, and I was like, no way. And a good friend said, you know, it's a good place to start, because when they first go on Instagram, they don't care who follows them. It's all of your friends, parents, it's your grandmother, it's your, you know, your aunt and your uncle. And it's a good playground for messing up, saying the wrong thing, doing the wrong thing. And if they don't have that, then they're not going to, you know, they're going to mess up bigger in Snapchat when you're not around.
Right. Yeah, I would liken it very much to the physical independence that we give our kids. You know, you don't just go from hold my hand when you cross the street to drop you off in the middle of town, right? There's intermediates. There's like, okay, I'm going to be on this side of the park and you're on the other side of the park, or, you know, I'm going to drop you off in front of the movie theater, but I'm going to pick you up right afterwards. So how do we have those training wheels in the social media era from around the same age points, right? From like 11 to 13, 14, 15, so that they have the tools to go on their own. And I completely agree with that idea of having, affording kids the space to make mistakes.
So the other thing you talk about, which is so difficult to talk about with children, is pornography, because it's just easily accessible. And you say the thing that I always say, it's out there and they're going to find it. They're going to see it. So it's not like if they do, they will, and probably younger than you think. What are your suggestions for parents to have that really difficult conversation with their kids about pornography?
It is really difficult. It's one of those things where you have to bite the bullet, and I would suggest being in a place where you don't have to look them in the eye. So people always suggest the car.
Yeah.
I think a good place for that. We're in Brooklyn and we don't drive so much, so it would be like just walking down the street, I guess, or maybe biking, actually. But just to, you know, what's helpful for kids is to understand a little bit, as much as you can share, about where porn comes from, and also what your personal values are about it. If it's religiously informed, if it's informed by feminism, you know, if there are other beliefs that you have that inform how you feel about pornography, I would suggest sharing that. And you know, with the where porn comes from, you know, just that it's commercial, it's a commercial enterprise. It's not just people having sex, and it's done for a purpose. I think kids are, as they start to be curious about these things, it could be very helpful for them to have that context and kind of think a little bit more about the fact that it's created with certain motives by people for certain reasons. That similar to kind of the truth campaign for tobacco for kids, where as an adolescent, you can kind of say, okay, I'm excited about this material, but I also have to think, maybe where does this come from? And is it really a good thing to have in the world?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a tough one. And so, did you find any parental controls that were at all effective? I know you write about what questions parents should ask themselves before they decide to have parental controls. There's all kinds of different factors. How do you already trust your kid? Have they proven to be trustworthy? But talk a little bit about your experience researching various parental controls that are out there.
Yeah, so this field is changing fast. And even just in the last month or so, you know, Google's updated their offerings, as has Amazon, has Apple, most famously. And so parental controls are really tough. I would say that, you know, with Apple building them into the OS and Google as well, there's more options available to parents than there were just a few months ago. And we may see even an explosion of different kinds of services that allow parents and kids to track their use. And I think the way that Apple's gone about it is pretty interesting insofar as they're really trying to push people to take a Fitbit approach, where it's like, first you measure and then you manage, right? And you figure out what are your goals and how do you want to work towards those goals. So that said, obviously the approach that I back as much as you can is giving your kids buy-in, you know, making sure that they understand why the rules are there, and giving them as much freedom as they can within those rules and the ability to kind of scaffold their own use and use their own executive functioning, right? So eventually you want to have kids who can by themselves say, hey, you know, this is what I want to get done today, so I'm turning off social media for a while. You don't want to always be there behind them helping them do it, because, you know, you're not always going to be there. So parental controls are something that can be a real time suck for parents, especially if they try to over control. But at the same time, if you want something that makes it harder for the kid to break the rules than not break the rules, certain kinds of controls can be helpful for that.
And you had a great piece on NPR about kids hacking the parental control, all on YouTube. All you have to do is search for like hack parental controls on Xbox, and there's all these cute little kids talking about how you can get through them. So and they're expensive too. I mean, it's one of those products really aimed at parents' fear and spending. You know, I'll spend however much money, and you know, on if you're going to keep my kids safe.
Right.
But what Apple's doing and what, you know, Google's doing is not really about like keeping your kids from finding porn. It's like you said, measuring how much time you're spending on it. It's not really, I mean, there's really no way to avoid that. You know, it's just conversation and make sure when they do see it that, you know, you've talked to them about it.
Yeah. You're going to be filtering all of the internet everywhere. I mean, that's not going to happen, because if you have six kids at a slumber party, you've got six phones.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And I mean, there's all kinds of apps, I think, that, I mean, I don't know if you've looked too much into Musical.ly, but that is the one that I feel like really comes up first. And it seems very innocent because we're just making little videos. But what are your thoughts on an app like Musical.ly?
Well, I agree. I think it has some great uses and some not so great uses. And a lot of it has to do with, do you have a family culture of showing your mom this cool video that you made, or is it something you would never ever show them because they would never like it? And you know, the other thing, I think what could be somewhat reassuring for parents is to understand that, you know, most research shows that kids who are being well parented and protected in most ways are not interested in talking to creepy adults. So when creepy adults try to approach most kids, they're not interested in the attention, they're not vulnerable toward it, they think it's gross. So unfortunately, obviously we have a lot of kids who are not being parented attentively or cared for. And so that there are people who are susceptible to approaches, but, the whole predator online thing is really, that's kind of what it's a factor of, and it's important to have that context.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I want to talk about gender. This, your chapter, the mom in the park on her iPhone, I think is a great title of chapter. And really a lot of the criticism comes down on moms. A lot of the judgment comes down on moms Tell me, why did you choose to devote such a big part of the book to this idea?
I think it was something that I was struggling with and trying to figure out why books like these were supposed to be for moms and why I as a mom struggled with it and trying to untangle the idea that we as parents are supposed to be around our kids and available to our kids all the time. And there's so much shaming that goes on, and women who do pretty much anything in public are ripe for harassment and for attacks. And so I think when it comes to an issue as intimate as what do I do with my kid, it's something that I really wanted to be protective of and think about carefully and say, yeah, there are times when we're not all being our best selves as parents, but when you set out to shame a mother for not acting the right way towards her child, you're partaking in this very long tradition of kind of mom bashing and saying, you know, and it's the kind of thing where even now as a working parent, you know, for several years, I still encounter this issue where I go to an event and someone's like, oh, where is your kids? You know, which I asked my husband the other day, he's like, no one's ever asked me that. Where's your kids? Like, oh my God, I forgot them in the car. Because you're not, it's like, if you have kids, where are they? That's the assumption, right?
Mm-hmm.
Parents are trying to be two places at once. Working moms especially are trying to be two places at once. And so I think that we are very prone to the temptation of distraction. And we're also spending more time on average with our kids. And so the opportunities for distraction are larger. So I know that a lot of moms struggle with this, and I wanted to kind of unpack that and realize, yeah, there's things we could be doing differently, but also don't judge other people.
Right. I mean, when we're accidentally on our iPhone at the dinner table, or, you know, when your kids are trying to tell you something, or, you know, at the beginning of a recital, we're probably doing some sort of parenting thing, you know, probably organizing the carpool, or we're doing a work thing because we're working extra. And, you know, it's like so much of that, so much of the work involved in parenting, I think often the texting work often falls to the mom, the volunteering.
The texting work.
The cognitive
burden, right? It's that labor that we're doing, that we're coordinating a million people, we're on the group chat, or we're, you know, exactly. We left work early to be at the work event, you know, we left work early to be at the kids event. And so then we're texting in with the boss and looking like a bad employee and a bad boss, you know?
And a lot of this is, I mean, my husband has tried to take on some of the texting work, and it's hard. Like moms are more, you know, it's like he's a teacher and he's home all summer, and it's like, I'm working, you know, arrange the play day with him. And, you know, it's hard for moms, you know, it's very hard, I think, for stay at home dads. I think this is an issue too, just having, getting the moms to accept you.
I know a couple who are both working, but her career is much more intense, and they've gone so far as to switch their names and their numbers on every list, because whether it's the camp or whether it's the doctor, they always call the mom first. And so now they call the mom and they reach the dad.
Oh, so let's talk a little bit about your other books, because this is not your first book, and you have some really interesting other books. Your most recent one was very sort of similar to this, the DIYU, that was 2010, and about how right there, about how education, the future of education. So it's kind of, I mean, it's the future 8 years later. What possessed you to write DIYU, and what has changed? Has anything big changed since you've written it?
Sure. So I did have a book in between. I had a book called The Test about standardized testing. But DIYU I love. It's a book about how higher ed has transformed to meet the issues of cost and quality and access. And a whole lot of what I talked about in the book is coming to pass in terms of learning shifting online, there being different kinds of paths to a degree, the whole kind of coder boot camp phenomenon. The MOOC phenomenon was something I talked about before it happened in the book, like free open online courses from major universities that were not accredited. So, you know, I think I would have to say that looking back on the things I talked about in the book, the sector of higher ed has changed a lot. There are a lot more options for people now to get a low cost degree that's public, that's online, and that is not subject to all the abuses of like the for-profit college industry. And there's a lot more recognition by colleges that they have to adapt. But, you know, on the public university funding side of things, it's still a pretty bleak picture and getting bleaker all the time because states don't want to pay for what it actually costs to educate people. So it's been an interesting time. I mean, I think I would say that higher ed has changed faster than I would have given it credit for in the almost a decade since I published that book.
Yeah, we didn't even. I had several questions about. You talk a lot about technology in the classroom, which is really, I mean, that's a big, not the higher ed classroom, but the lower elementary school and kindergarten. Yeah. And that's a big issue. I get a lot of my parent friends just saying, you know, how can you get your kid off a screen if the iPad is where their homework is? I think I haven't given away all the spoilers. So if you are interested in technology in the classroom and what's working and what's not necessarily working, I haven't given that away. You can definitely read about that in The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life by Anya Kamenetz, who is a reporter for NPR. You can hear her on NPR, and I listen to the Up First, and you're often on that too, the little quick NPR short podcast, and I love your pieces on that too. So is there any other place that people, where's the best place for people to find all your books and anything else that you're working on besides going to NPR?
You can go to myfirstnamelastname.net, AnyaKamenetz.net, and that's where I have all my books and info and my newsletter, which comes out once a month. So, yeah, that's the best place. And Twitter. I'm on Twitter.
Awesome. And do you have an idea for another book that you can, your next book that you can talk about yet?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, there's so much fun, interesting, I wouldn't say fun, stuff happening around tech and ethics and the broader conversation that is connected with this this stuff of how we raise great kids in this crazy changing atmosphere. So I'm just curious to see where that conversation goes.
Yeah, I didn't mention the end of your book also talking about the future of parenting and AI and just, you know, the baby monitor leading to 1984 possibly. All of that.
Yeah.
So it's a great book. Definitely try the download the Kindle sample and you will be hooked. And I also like that you have at the end a little too long didn't read section that for busy parents. Thank you so much for coming on, Anya.
Thanks so much for having me. This was really fun.
And thank you for joining us on Triangulation. Triangulation records every week on Friday at 3 p.m. Pacific, and it is hosted by Leo Laporte and Jason Howell and myself. And if you have suggestions for people you think we should talk to, you can email those suggestions to megan@twit.tv. And I also host iOS Today on Tuesdays, and I host Tech News Weekly on Thursdays. And if you love this show, please subscribe to it. Go to twit.tv/try. And of course, you can watch live at twit.tv/live, but you can also get it. You can watch it on YouTube. You can watch it on any TV. Watch it together. Watch it with your family. Screens together, mostly together. That's what Anya says. We'll see you next week.